Okay, now it's my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Her name is Erica, so let's please offer her a warm Valley Group welcome.
I'm Erica, I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Okay. Whew, I'm nervous. First, Bill, thank you so much for asking me to be of service. It's still terrifying. I just want to welcome all the newcomers. One day is a miracle. To put a couple of those together is an even bigger accomplishment. So I'm pretty overwhelmed by how full this room is and how many miracles are in here. Deep breath. So my sobriety date is December 15th, 1998. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have girls that I work with. Some of them are actually cool enough and they're sponsors now too. It feels pretty awesome. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was taught to stay to the format in my sobriety. I came from a very beautifully dysfunctional, loving, chaotic family. My mom got sober when I was 2. She didn't get sane, she got sober. My father is an amazing enabler and a pedophile who did not spare his children. So needless to say, the idea of boundaries, the idea of consistency, I was not brought up with that. I was brought up with a lot of rules, a lot of rigidity, and a lot of inconsistencies. I was brought up with wanting to escape my feelings from the time I can remember knowing I had a feeling. I used to get into the medicine cabinet. My father was a physician assistant. I used to get into her medicine cabinet. You can think of how amazingly epic that was. Because all I remember is not wanting to be me, whatever that meant. The first time I remember breaking into it, I was about 3 or 4. And I only remember that because I would go to preschool. And I just remember it still never being enough. I remember walking into anywhere and feeling off. I'm not enough. And like that skin crawling feeling. But again, at 3 or 4, there's no way I could put words to those feelings. It was just I was uncomfortable. And I thought everyone else must feel this way. My disease started with anything that would get me out of self, whether it be in the medicine cabinet, whether it be a bowl of food, whether it be in the refrigerator. It didn't matter. It's the same disease. I just didn't want to be me. So I did everything to extremes. I remember going down and breaking into the fridge and then waking up underneath a bar stool the next morning, not remembering what I ate, what I did, and then trying to get back up to my room. And then I remember my parents booby trapping the fridge because I couldn't stop breaking into it. And all I really wanted was the sugar, anything to get me out of self. You know, with my mom being sober when I was 2, my dad had a liquor cabinet, but I didn't really find it until after I started babysitting for people that didn't mind that I got into theirs. They were awesome. I always babysat for them. And then, you know, I got sober young. I got sober at 19, so my disease progressed fast, and part of my disease was also the look good, getting sober and seeing what that looked like for my mom. I would go to meetings with her. I mean, when I was little, I was in meetings where everyone was still smoking. She got sober up in Georgetown in Auburn, California. Dark, dark rooms, lots of cigarettes, lots of bikers. So for me to see men crying in this dark, smoky-filled room was so creepy to me. I just wanted to go outside and play with the other AA kids that were running around. But I also wanted nothing my mom had because my disease was not of myself, right? At that point, it was all my mom's fault. It was everybody else's fault. It was all external. And also, growing up in a sober household, look good was vital. It kept my mom off my back. So as my disease progressed, everything stayed good. So the first time I remember blacking out, I think I was about 12. Kid had his big brother's kegger, so he stole a couple cups of booze and came over, and I took one, and the other 3 had to fight for themselves. And I didn't see a problem with it. I really didn't understand why everybody else did. I remember throwing it back, kind of coming to again and looking, and they're all furious. how did I not share? And I thought, I'm not supposed to. I'm eyeing their other cup. Like, I need that. The bottom line is it was never enough. However, my grades stayed good. I was in sports. That kept my mom off my back. Everything on the outside was great, except for I was dying on the inside. I thought everybody else must be dying on the inside. Everybody else must be terrified of facing anybody. Like right now, this is still terrifying. Standing up here and sharing anything about myself is terrifying. But this is what I learned in this program. I don't get to keep it unless I give it away. And so my disease progressed. I got a sports-ending injury, well, for that year in high school, and instead of doing what the doctors thought I should do, I thought, this is a perfect time to experiment. I'm going to show those people. So I drank, and then I did other substances, because again, it was never enough. I was a garbage can. It didn't matter what people had. Whatever crowd I was in, that's what I did. I just didn't want to be me. I didn't want to feel anything I felt. I didn't want to know anything that I knew. I just didn't want to be me. Again, grades stayed good. That was part of my disease. Then I got into college. I got a sports scholarship, got an academic scholarship. Again, everything on the outside's all pretty, right? Flowers keep everybody from really looking at you really close, not realizing I'm dying. Like it says in our literature, I had to be the best to just be good enough. The secret is, it's never good enough. If my disease is in control, it will never, ever be enough. Whether it's good enough, enough numbing, enough of anything. Went to college, perfect time to really experiment and let my disease kind of see what was going on. And there's a lot of other substances out there that help you see what your disease is made of. So I made friends with all different circles, but again, my disease, the look good, I did not want my family to know anything. My mom was sober, my stepdad was sober, everyone around me was sober, and I didn't want what they had, I didn't have their problem, I drank because I liked the taste, everybody blacks out, everybody drives in blackouts. Like, duh, that's what you do. Why would you go to a party and have a beer? That seemed absolutely stupid. As a designated driver, I would still black out. I really didn't see a problem with it. I will totally be your DD. I'm sorry I'm drunk. It'll be fine. We won't get caught. The other thing about my drinking is I was a rager. I was not a fun, happy party girl. I was a fighter. All my anger, all my pain, all my fear came out when I drank and did other substances. It didn't matter what it was. I fought. Didn't matter who, didn't matter why. I would make up some reason in my head and then I would pick a fight. It was always their fault because they looked at me funny, they said something funny, they bumped me, they breathed. Didn't matter. That's how I got out my rage. I always could get out of it, right? We're the master manipulators of our lives. Until we're not, and until it stops working. So in college, while I kept the good grades and I kept the sports going, the disease was catching up with me. I started writing papers drunk and getting them back with, I don't know what any of this means. You may want to rethink this whole thing. And in my sober breath, I looked at it and I was like, I don't know what any of it means either. I don't even know what the assignment was. I don't even remember writing this. But it's not that bad. Because I haven't gotten a DUI, I haven't gotten in a car accident. I've woken up in places I don't remember getting to with people I would choose not to remember. But that's not that bad because I have all my limbs or because I know where my car is, kind of. It was never that bad, right? And then I sought lower companions because then it couldn't be that bad because I wasn't where they were. And then the disease caught me. I met a boy. You know, he was going to be the knight in shining armor. He had white substances, but it wasn't a horse. And he wasn't a knight. However, he was my disease's best friend. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, my disease kept me feeling safe, protected, in control, invincible, okay. At no point did I think my disease was lying, was manipulating, was trying to kill me. I literally thought this is like the deal. So when I met this guy who was basically the embodiment of my disease, I was like, hey, we're going to get married. We're going to have love children. It's going to be amazing. I don't remember the next month and a half of my life. I do remember never having oil in my car, gas in my car, money to pay bills. Mind you, I had like a $50 rent payment at the time, and I couldn't make it. I do remember begging money off of the day laborers at the gas stations when gas was 98 cents a gallon, begging for a couple dollars. Like, hey, hi, can I have some money? I'm like 18, 19, not thinking it's that big of a deal, wondering why they're giving me the dirtiest looks. I thought, this isn't too much to ask, buddy. I just need some money for my gas. And they're trying to get a job, right? And I'm going to my job and I don't have gas. Right. But again, I'm not that bad. You know, I have the nice clothes, the look good is there, but I'm dying. I'm dying. So around that time, I'm working. I drop out of college because college isn't the answer. Working at Gap is my life purpose. I can go drunk. That's right. I can go drunk. I can go hungover. I can go loaded. It doesn't matter. You can put on a face. The best actors I've ever met are the people in these rooms. The best people to show that everything's okay are the people in these rooms. So I was like, I got this. Little did I know it was catching up with me. And the jig was up. I had a boss basically saying, you need to get yourself together or you're getting fired. I had where I was living with my aunt and uncle say, you need to get yourself together or we're kicking you out. I had friends saying, I really don't like you anymore and we're not hanging out. I stopped being invited. I stopped being called. Nothing was enough. The month and a half I don't remember. I'm grateful. However, it still wasn't enough when I came to again. I still was me. I still had the feelings. I wasn't able to get drunk anymore, so I went to other substances, and then I went to other substances, and I went back to booze, and it didn't matter. It was never enough. I couldn't get drunk. The disease was winning. I was getting beat. My bottom was Halloween of 98. I was with that knight in shining armor. I OD'd when I came to halfway through because I was with a dealer. He was best friends with the dealer, so no one's calling anybody. No one's dropping you off. You're staying where you're at. Good luck. I OD'd, came to. I was being sexually assaulted by that knight in shining armor. And I just remember feeling like, I want to die. I'm good. I'm over it. It's not that bad, but I want to die. I happened to wake up the next morning. Thank you, God. Happened to wake up the next morning, and I realized something's got to give. My sister at that point was already sober, which was weird. The only time we got along was when we drank together. During that last year, her first year of sobriety, she'd already called to make an amends, called to see how I was. I remember looking at the phone like, who is she? You're sorry?
Ugh.
I drink because it tastes good. Literally, that would be the connection of the conversation. Like, how are you doing? I drink because it tastes good. I don't have you and Mom's problem. And she told me that once I got sober. She's like, this is the funniest conversations I've ever had. And all I remember from every conversation was she would say, methinks you doth protest too much, which means for the rest of the people, you're BSing. You're full of it. The disease of denial sometimes is a bit stronger than the disease of active drinking and other substances because it keeps me sick, keeps my secrets. However, I heard hope, and I called it, and I was learned to call it a God shot. I remember breaking down and telling her only a smidge, but she heard the desperation, she heard the shame, because I remember waking up that next day, November 1st, going, oh my God, I have no idea what's going on in my life. So when I called my sister from my work, I was crying in the front while customers are coming in. I didn't see a problem with that, by the way. I had things I needed to talk about with my sister. They could help themselves. Again, showing up to work on time was a lot to ask someone, okay? I mean, and consistently, that boss was a slave driver. So I called her, and all I kept saying is, don't tell Mom. Whatever you do, don't tell Mom, because my mom was sober. And I didn't want Mom to know. Moms don't have to know specifics, they just know. It's really creepy, by the way. For all you moms out there, it's a little creepy. She didn't tell my mom. She didn't have to. I got a call from my mom the next day. And all my mom said was, if you're willing to go to counseling, because I was in L.A., I will drive down there right now and I will bring you home. And I was in the Bay Area. I was going back to the Bay. And all I heard come out of my mouth, which was my second God shot, was, okay. And I remember hearing okay and being like, this is the worst choice ever. But I didn't think I could change my mind. Again, another God shot. Okay, and my mouth shut. I had nothing more to say. So my mom moves me home. And all my youth and buddies were like, what are you doing? You're ruining it. And I was like, I have to. I just kept hearing myself say, I have to. I'll be back. I'm just going to get my stuff together. Things will settle. I'll be back. Right. They all knew that that wasn't going to happen because half of them had been moved from up north down south to go to rehabs. Right. So I go home and I go to therapy, and I thought, it took me probably 5 years into sobriety to realize it was only about a month of therapy till it all soaked in. I thought it was like 6 months. No. A month of therapy after the first session, my therapist started putting the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on the table. Mm-hmm. Every session. Real subtle. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I've seen that. My mom and my sister have a problem. I don't. She wouldn't say anything. And then one day she said, do you think this might be a problem? Nope. I drink because it tastes good. Okay. But she planted a seed. And I remember one day after therapy, I came home, I sat in a chair, did what we normally do, talked to my mom, tell her how it went, wah-wah-wah-wah-wah. And out of my mouth, a next God shot. Mom, I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, oh my God, my life's over. And her face was, oh my God, what? And my sister, I could hear upstairs, was just stoked, like, yes! The disease of denial is starting to stop with our family, thank goodness. And my sister took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I still shake thinking about it. It was the 449 group in San Francisco, California. It was a big book thumping meeting and tradition thumping meeting. You don't do anything out of their profile. Everything is like legit. It's serious. It is a heavy meeting. And of course we sat front row. I was like her pony on show. Oh, this is your sister. Hi. I could barely get two words out. But again, we're all great actors. I smiled and pretended. They could see I was dying. They could see that I was at an end. Emotionally, spiritually, physically, I couldn't get drunk anymore. The feelings were overwhelming. I was over it, but I didn't know what to do. I had no intention of staying. I had no intention of staying in Alcoholics Anonymous, let alone sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had heard of the marijuana maintenance plan. My sponsor kindly said, no. So my first meeting, the biggest thing I banked my entire drinking career on was that I was like my father. That first meeting, I had to announce I was an alcoholic because my sister was staring at me and everyone else was because they knew I was, you know, the new puppy on stage. So when I announced myself as an alcoholic, I couldn't stop crying. I felt like my life was over. This was the worst. I was only 19. I thought, I'm not supposed to remember my 21st birthday. What am I doing getting sober now? Like, I at least should have a couple more years out there. That wasn't God's plan. And then this man stood up to share during the meeting, and he basically was my father. Different name, different face. And I thought, oh no, I might actually qualify for this thing. Because if I'm like my father, and my father's in these rooms, this is horrible. So I did what everyone is told to do when you come in these rooms, right? You get a sponsor, you work the steps, you're of service, that whole deal. I had my first sponsor in 19 years, no idea what to do with me. We would meet and have tea, and then she would tell me to go ask other people at meetings how they did their steps. And luckily for my sister, she would say, that's not right. So she said, I know someone that's going to be your sponsor. This is when I first learned what to be voluntold was. You don't volunteer, you're voluntold. My biggest character defect is people-pleasing. However, it is absolutely an asset. When I first came in, I wanted to be liked. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be enough. So I did what all the people that stuck around did. I went to 90 and 90. That's what I was brought up with, 90 meetings in 90 days. And getting sober in the Bay Area, you have no excuses. I got a sponsor. That one didn't work, so I got a second sponsor. She gave me 5 numbers and said, call me until you get a hold of me. You'll never get a call back from me. How bad do you want it? If you're not on your 4-step, or if you've heard of it, you can guarantee she was on like the next 5 fourth steps, which is basically an inventory of everyone you hate. Eventually you get to your part, but that was definitely on the top of my list because didn't she know who I was? Didn't she know my needs? Like, I'm Erica, I need help. She was like, how bad do you want it? Work for it. But something about her I loved. There was something in her I liked. I couldn't put my finger on it. I didn't get it. So I did everything that she told me to do. I went to 90 and 90. I got a service position. You know, before I had enough time where meetings would allow, I would wash coffee cups, I would be a greeter, anything. That first step, what I've been taught, is the most important. To admit I'm absolutely licked. That my life is completely unmanageable. If I can do that and not pick up, sometimes it was one moment at a time, then there's hope. So then she made me talk to people. If I had 12 days, she made me talk to someone who had 10. She said, you have 2 more days of experience than they do. Maybe one of those days is a miracle. You have to talk to them. Horrifying. I may seem like an extrovert. I'm not. I'm an introvert. I like my alone time. I like being with my dogs. It's terrifying to go up to strangers. It's still terrifying. However, if I want what someone else has, I do what they do. So I started working the steps of that first sponsor. You know, and the second and third step were difficult because I did not want to have a relationship with a higher power. When I came in these rooms, I had a big problem with the word God. I had a big problem with the verbiage in the book. I had a problem with the he's and the hymns and all of that. So my sponsor said, fine, in a meeting to adhere to the traditions, you read the black as it is written. When you're doing your steps at home, you can play with it a little bit because this is your sobriety. Whatever will keep you coming back. Okay. So for the second and third steps, she let me just kind of play with it for my idea of a higher power. I didn't know I got to choose my idea of a higher power. I thought I had to adopt from something else. She said, if you don't want to believe in that, believe in a doorknob. Believe in a light switch. Something you can't fully explain, but you have faith it'll work every time you use it. Oh. So I did. I didn't get it, but I did to the best of my ability. And that fourth step, doing the inventory, that was probably the most terrifying thing. When I came in, I thought, if you really knew who I was, and there's times I still struggle with it, you won't like me, you won't accept me, and you'll know I'm not enough. It was amazing to have all my stuff written down. And my biggest, deepest, darkest secret, the funny thing is somehow my higher power, which I choose to call God, God picks a sponsor that usually has been there and then some. So you say your deepest, darkest secret, and it's usually hilarious to them. And that's been my experience with my girls. Like, really? Oh, yeah, let me tell you one of mine. And then we all laugh and we realize it's not this horrible secret that no one else has gone through. I was one of many all of a sudden. Oh my gosh, I'm not this weird foreign object. Like, I'm one of many. I actually belong in these rooms. So sitting and telling another person exactly who I was, who I'm still struggling being, and who I would actually like to be was pretty amazing. You know, and something that I still do with my girls is my first sponsor would have us, we met in Golden Gate Park, and she said, get your comfort food, and it's fried chicken, mashed potatoes, gravy, and coleslaw. Like, I still love it. It's like crack. It's delicious. However, my experience is also with my girls, I'm never hungry until I get that fifth step out of the way, until I dump. And then I can feel the relief, and then I could eat and stuff my face. And I still do that with my girls because the whole point was to show you're worth the effort. You're worth the comfort. You're worth this step. 6 and 7, admitting shortcomings and knowing that your higher power is the only one that can relieve them. It's a trickier step. It took me a little bit to get it. Doing it, you know, traditionally by the big book, it's, you know, you admit, you write down your faults, and then you say your 7-step prayer, and then you move on to step 8. You know, and I've had a lot of different sponsors and had a lot of different ways of doing it. Step 8, writing down all the amends that you need to make, all the people that you have harmed. That was another tough one because I thought that meant I was, again, a piece of trash. I thought, again, that meant that it was no good. My sponsor showed me that there's freedom in that step when we are willing to admit and humble ourselves before the people we have harmed. There's freedom in admitting I'm a human being. I didn't know that. I thought I had to be a human doing. I thought what I had, what I made, was who I was, not my essence, not with what's within. You know, and step 10 is continue to take personal inventory, you know, and that way I don't have to do another official 8 and 9 or 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That gets a little easier as I've stayed sober. It's all progress. It's all continuing. It's amazing. Step 11 is, you know, prayer meditation, getting a conscious contact, which means having having a constant dialogue with something that I see as my higher power. For me, that's freeing. My sponsor taught me, so I'm never alone when I struggle. It doesn't matter what it is. Look at a doorknob, talk to the doorknob. It doesn't matter. And step 12, the amazing thing that this meeting focuses on is being of service to the newcomer, to the person that's struggling. You know, in sobriety, I did what I was taught to do. I did everything I was taught, and I still wasn't feeling better. And I got those sponsees, and most of them went out in the beginning. And again, I wasn't telling all of my secrets. I was telling the big ones. I didn't know, like it says in our literature, it's the little stuff that'll take us out. I wasn't sharing the daily crazies. I wasn't sharing when my mind would wander. I wasn't sharing when the disease was really, really winning. I kept it all in, and I kept the facade, and I was looking good, and I was sober in the bay, and right, the whole look good. The disease was still alive and well. I was sober. I had 8 years. Disease was alive and well. Then we moved here, me and my husband. He got a job. And I use this area as my excuse to not go to meetings. They don't do it right, right? All the excuses. If you've ever moved in sobriety, they don't do it right. It's not right. Wah, 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 wah. Number one reason, excuses, Erica doesn't want to. At that time, more was being revealed. All the memories of my father started coming back about that time. Didn't want to face it. Again, I'm sober. The look good's there. I didn't want to face it. So I stopped going to meetings. Didn't go for 3 years. Wow. Spiritual death, they say. Spiritual death. I did not have to drink or pick up any other substance to know what it is to die again. I knew misery. I knew shame. I knew embarrassment. I knew my disease was alive and well because my look good was still there, but nothing else was behind it. I couldn't look people in the eye again. I was seeking lower companions again. They didn't happen to drink, but they would definitely co-sign any of my BS. So I thought, oh yeah, I'm okay, because they say I'm okay. Well, consider the source, sweet face. Like, geez Louise. And then more was revealed. And all the memories of my father came back. And around that time, I have a little Eskimo, and she couldn't make it tonight. We met outside of these rooms. We have the same profession. And she could see me a mile away for what I was. And it was after a couple times of hanging out that she finally nailed me. So you ever go to meetings? I think I never talked about this part of my life. And I was like, no, they're good. You know, I'm good. Like, I'm so good. I'm just so happy. I'm so happy. Right. And we know we've all done that, right? Like, I'm so good. Just ask me. And this is when I finally decided to get out of the driver's seat, which I was doing a wonderful job, I might add, of misery. And I let God take over. And the God shot was, I said, no, I haven't been in 3 years. Just shy of my, yeah, I was 11 and a half years sober when I came back to meetings. And I went to a sister program of ours because Alcoholics Anonymous was not going to be my solution. I would show my family. Right, here I am. So I went to the sister program, and it didn't matter. God didn't care. God was like, wherever you're going to get your recovery, you got to get it. So I went to the sister program, and I started to hear God again. I started to see hope again. I started to feel again. I started to realize what my disease really was. I truly thought when I came in, because I came in so young, and I had such a long yet list in terms of DUIs. Basically, I hadn't gotten caught yet. But I thought, then that means I don't belong. And when I came back to meetings, I realized my disease is here. It has nothing to do with what substances I put in my body. It's here. If I don't take care of this, I'm going to go out. And if I don't go out, I'm going to be in hell. And I can tell you, for 3 years, the look good was there. My husband didn't even know I was drowning in my own stuff. The disease was great. So I came back to meetings and immediately started working my steps. This woman I trusted, we were good friends, and I said, will you sponsor me? Again, talking to strangers, reaching out was not an option. That was terrifying. And she said, absolutely. Okay, let's get started. So we started, and it was all about the dad stuff. And I sought outside help because I needed a professional to help me go through to those depths to make sure I come out of that rabbit hole and I don't get stuck. However, without the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps, there's no way I can hear anything else. I can't hear any other spiritual ventures I go on. I can't hear a therapist. I can't do any of that. I have to have this. This is the only thing I have found in my experience to quiet my disease. Everything else is an amazing add-on for me, but for me, this, it has to start here, or I get lost in the shuffle so fast. So we worked together for about a year, and then our relationship was changing, and I wanted to be friends. So then I found this sassy white-haired lady with red lipstick on and red outfit, and she's just sashaying around the rooms. I know. She's sashaying. And I come from a very serious family, very serious program. It's all serious. And here's this woman who just smiles and laughs, like a free laugh, like what I've seen in the rooms. And I thought, there's no way that's possible. And at about 12 and a half years of sobriety, I walked up to her after a meeting. I chaired it. It was a Rule 62 meeting. Those that don't know what Rule 62 means, it means don't take yourself so seriously. Didn't know that when I chaired that meeting, by the way. Joke was on Erica. I'd never been roasted after a chair before. That was awesome. Especially by people I didn't really know. Like, awkward. But something about it, like, ignited in me. It was another God shot. All of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, I'm not having fun in sobriety. Why am I doing this then? Like, great, the spirituality is great, but if I can't have it go into every other part of my life, why am I here? So I asked this little lady to be my sponsor, and she said, sure, call me every day for 2 weeks, and then we'll talk. Okay. Didn't care. My time no longer mattered. My experience no longer mattered. The amount of sponsors I have had no longer mattered. I wanted what she had, so I did everything that she did. I was a newcomer again emotionally, and that's exactly what I needed. So I started from the ground up. We started from the steps, old school, as if it was my very first time going through. That was my first experience of what old timers had said, when you let the steps work you. You can work the steps for years, but until they've actually worked you, keep coming back. Thank goodness I didn't quit before the miracle. All of a sudden I started feeling the comfort, the calm. I could smile without it being fake. I didn't have a mask on. Like, it was amazing. I could actually look people in the eye again. I actually had joy for my life again. And then she also taught me how to sponsor women. I had never had a sponsor feel so passionate about sponsorship and service work that actually was so big on, this is how you do it. This is how to be the most effective to these young women. This is how to show them how to do it. This is how we show us how to stand up on our own, one foot in front of the other. That's it. I had no idea. I never had a sponsor, or I wasn't willing. Jury's still out on that one. Probably the latter. I wasn't willing or ready. But I'd never had someone feel so much passion about it. And then all of a sudden I found that everything in my life was getting better. The promises were really happening. My marriage was better. I didn't even know it was terrible, by the way. I was holding a hostage for 3 years. Didn't know, the poor guy. You know, my in-laws, they're addicts. Well, they died of this disease. We lost my mother-in-law 6 years ago of an overdose, and my father-in-law 3 years of an overdose. She was just shy of her 51st birthday. He was just shy of his 53rd. That's young. When I was 19, that didn't sound young, but that's young. All of a sudden, I'm doing things in my life I never thought. I'm agreeing to speak at a podium microphone thing. When I'm sweating, I wore a patterned shirt on purpose so you can't see my armpit sweat. Because it is still terrifying to me to expose who I am. It is still terrifying to say I don't know. I'm just finishing up my 12th step on some other stuff. As more layers are revealed, sometimes you have to go back through the steps formally. And so I realized that I needed to go back through the steps formally again, and my sponsor agreed. And I realized, in BSing on this 12th step again, the last time I did it too, I have no idea why, is all the old fears of not being enough come up. Because it's all about being of service, getting out of self, being there for the next alcoholic woman. That's terrifying, because what if I'm not enough? And then luckily I have a higher power that says, well, good, it's not about you and you don't get to make those opinions. Just put one foot in front of the other and move forward. And so here I am standing, being of service, because that's what I was taught, because I wanted what other women had that did this. I remember watching young women speak and being like, that is so amazing. How do they have the guts to do that? You just do it, because I want to stay. I don't want to go back out. I'm the only person still sober in the circle of people I got sober with. The only one. I got sober in young people's AA in Oakland, California. I'm an Oakland girl. The only one still sober. Odds are always against me. So the fact that any of us have 24 hours, 5 minutes in a row is a miracle. The fact that the only difference, my sponsor reminds me of this, the only difference between her and I, other than years, is she's been practicing this longer. She doesn't know it. She's been practicing this whole deal longer. I was taught the phrase kindergarten AA. When in doubt, go back to kindergarten AA. Keep it simple. 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3. Today, I share every little niche with my sponsor, every little crazy, everything. When I think it's insignificant, I share it anyways, because my disease is looking for any in, any way to kill me. I have made it through things in sobriety and even recently that I thought I would drink over. I actually guaranteed I would drink over, and I didn't. I am so grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and especially when I came in and I didn't plan on staying. There's no way I would have been like, yeah, you know, in a few years, you know, hey, I'm going to go chair a meeting. That'd be awesome. Like, no, it's like my life is over. And instead, I have found friendships that are fulfilling. I have found a way of life that is fulfilling. I am able to look people in the eye, and for me, that's an invaluable gift, to actually look someone in the eye. I never could do it before. Today, I don't have to have a mask on. I can just be Erica, whatever that is that day, and it varies. And today, I get to keep practicing the steps of this program, so I get to keep getting what I'm getting, and my sponsor reminds me, if I don't like what I'm getting, then change what I'm doing. Nothing changes if nothing changes. So thank you again for asking me to be of service, Bill. And thank you, everyone. And again, congratulations to everyone in this room. Thank you.